It's Morning Edition here on NHPR. I'm Rick Gamley, and this is the New Hampshire News Recap. Reports of immigration and customs enforcement in Manchester schools spread across social media and within local communities this week. The Manchester School District says it has not received any substantiated reports of ICE activity, but it will continue to monitor the situation. Joining me now with more is NHPR's Lau Guzman. Good morning, Lau.
Hi, Rick. Good morning.
First, what do we actually know about ICE activity in the city of Manchester?
Honestly, not much. We do know that they have been active in the city in the past, but it's kind of difficult to track where and when, as ICE hasn't responded to several requests for confirmation. So in that data void, where it's like tough to know what's actually ICE and what's something else, local police are often more responsive, since ICE sometimes gives them a heads up that they are in the area. And yesterday, a spokesperson for the department said that the chief had no credible information about an increased ICE presence.
I know that you were at a school yesterday, and we sent some other reporters out as well. What do we know about the reaction at local schools in the city and elsewhere?
Yeah, so we've heard lots of different things since October, but we've only been able to verify one ICE arrest in front of Central High in October. Yesterday, my colleague Anne-Marie Timmons and I spent the morning just kind of checking in at different places, and it seemed like pickup and drop off went off normally. And I haven't heard about anything else at school so far.
Well, Lau, where did these claims of ICE activity come from? Why were there so many things swirling around social media about it?
Yeah, I wish I had a good answer for you, Rick, but right now it's unclear. What I will say is whoever decided to start those claims was certainly coming from, you know, a good enough source that school leadership would send an email to staff on Wednesday evening to address this concern and say that they would monitor the situation. So whoever said that must have been, you know, pretty credible.
Yeah. As I said earlier, Lau, we were hearing reports about this via social media yesterday morning. In fact, and we sent, you know, you and other reporters out and you know, we were wondering, how do we talk about this on air without, you know, obviously just, you know, reporting rumors. So how do you go about trying to verify claims like this when you see them on social media?
Yeah, I mean, I think the kind of gold standard for this is being able to verify it ourselves, you know, to be there, be able to, like, you know, talk to people on scene, witness it, maybe even record it ourselves. I do this fairly often when I get a tip, but ICE detentions are usually pretty quick. So I have yet to be on site for a detention. So if I can't be there, video evidence taken by activists, bystanders, or something posted on social media is often helpful because, and that's the thing, right? You mentioned it earlier. You really have to be so careful with this stuff. You know, you have to make sure that it's real, that it was taken at the date and time that it says it was, that it was taken at the location that it says it was, that it's not regular law enforcement, that it's not old footage, that someone else can verify what happened, that sort of thing, help us figure out what actually happened.
And of course, online, we see this all the time, old footage being reused like that. But it's, again, it's old fashioned reporting, it's being on site, it's verifying, and it's getting multiple sources. Lau, since President Trump returned to office, you've seen all kinds of misinformation circulate across social media about ICE activity here. Again, as a reporter, how do you see your role in this and verifying this and getting the story and not, you know, perpetuating rumors?
Yeah, I kind of think of my job as sorting through the noise to figure out what's actually happening. I don't know if there's like any Ratatouille fans in our audience, but I think about this like one scene all the time where Chef Skinner is talking to his lawyer. He's in his office and he's trying to figure out what the deal is with the whole like Remy Linguini thing. Like, is there a rat in his kitchen? And his eyes bug out and he's so stressed because he's not sure what's real and what's his imagination. And I think we're kind of in like a Chef Skinner moment right now. Like, if you spend too much time on social media, I think it is kind of easy to get into Chef Skinner mode.
Okay.
And that like isn't productive either. So I do spend a decent chunk of time chasing down these reports and trying to figure out what actually happened and what's, you know, maybe old or, you know, not super current.
Yeah, maybe we should all spend a little less time on social media. You had a story this week about one family in New Hampshire and how they've had to navigate encounters with ICE and detention. How did you first learn about that situation?
Yeah, it was a call from an activist at the Granite State Organizing Project in September, actually. They run a hotline for potential ICE actions, so when they get the call, they mobilize volunteers to verify and record the action. And the activist that called me told me that there was a woman whose husband had a court date for a DWI charge, but she was scared that ICE might pick him up. So I showed up and have been following the case for a few months now.
What'd you learn about their experience?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is something new, but it absolutely humbles me every single time I encounter it. I think the resilience of immigrant communities is always so astounding. I mean, I had to cut a lot of this for time, so it didn't make it to air, but I think the community response never ceases to amaze me. I mean, this family has been through kind of a lot. And I think in difficult times like this, there's always this impulse to keep to yourself, to, keep your head low, to, not talk out. But the community around her has been advocating for this family for nearly a decade now. And I think this community support is always really beautiful to witness, how people, band together to help each other out.
And that's something I've seen as a theme in your reporting here about the community at large. As you continue reporting these stories here in New Hampshire, what are you keeping an eye on? What kind of stories are you following?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we're going to keep on following is infrastructure. It's been nearly a year since FCI Berlin started taking immigration detainees, and they detained over 200 people last year. So we'll see if that increases this year. And obviously, my colleagues have done some excellent reporting on ICE plans to build, a holding place at a Merrimack warehouse. And the Portsmouth Herald, did say that the county jail in Rockingham received a contract to hold immigration detainees. So this infrastructure bit, I think, is going to be crucial. And then, always our legislature is an infinite story engine. It's kind of easy to ignore because policy isn't exactly super flashy. But I am following several projects in the legislature, including a few that would add requirements to 287G agreements for local police and one that seeks to eliminate the refugee resettlement program here in New Hampshire.
NH Paris Lau Guzman. Thanks so much for the time this morning, Lau.
Thanks for the invite, Rick.
You can find more of her work and all of our immigration coverage, in fact, that she's been talking about online at nhpr.org. Now, Lau alluded to that warehouse in Merrimack that's been the subject of intense scrutiny since last month when the Washington Post reported there were plans for a 1,500-bed ICE detention facility at the site. The Boston Globe's Amanda Gokey is in studio this morning and has been following the story and joins us now to talk about that. Welcome, Amanda.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back and Happy New Year. First time we've seen each other in 2026. Amanda, these plans for an ICE facility in Merrimack have not been confirmed, as Lau said, but what do we know now from local officials? What are they saying?
Yeah, so officials at the town have really said they're still in the dark about this. They're looking for more information, but again, have not gotten that official confirmation yet of anything concrete. There was a Democratic state representative who is from Merrimack. She shared a document on social media that she believes is credible. She believes it was leaked from ICE, and it purports to show the addresses of warehouses that ICE officials are supposedly touring around the country. There's about 23 of these sites, and it did include this one address in Merrimack. So, now residents have really been honing in on that specific warehouse in their community. They're showing up there. I spoke with local police who said, just in light of the leak and that document, they haven't been able to, verify its authenticity, but they're still keeping an eye on this location since there just is so much interest right now. And people are really trying to figure out what is going on at that location.
Are the feds saying anything more?
I did actually hear back from an ICE spokesperson when I reached out about this facility. They did not confirm or deny any of the details related to the warehouse location, but they did acknowledge that the agency is actively working to expand its detention capacity. They said that these facilities will not be warehouses, but that they would be, quote, very well structured detention facilities meeting our regular detention standards, unquote. They said that these new facilities will be funded through the One Big Beautiful Bill, which, as you remember, was signed by President Trump this past summer. But they also said they have no new detention facilities to announce at this time.
Okay. So at the moment, we don't have any kind of timeline on this or even verification that it is going to happen in Merrimack.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, right now we're sort of left with a lot of speculation. There's the Washington Post reporting that pointed to Merrimack. There's this leaked document. There's certainly intense sort of interest and scrutiny to see what happens next. But so far, I think we're still waiting to really confirm the details on this.
Again, it comes down to sifting through the rumors and finding fact, which is what we do here. I want to turn to another story that you were covering this week, Amanda. Earlier this month, federal officials dropped the number of vaccines recommended for children, and now it's up to the state as to whether they will adopt those same recommendations. What's been the reaction from local health officials?
So state health officials have said that, you know, New Hampshire's vaccine recommendations remain unchanged. They're sort of sticking with the guidance that they have received in the past from these major medical organizations. They are, you know, not currently matching any of the changes that are made by the federal government most recently. You know, they've said New Hampshire residents can still access all of the vaccines as normal. Commercial insurers have agreed to continue covering those, at least for now. But some health officials who are on the ground with patients said the new guidance is really creating some confusion and undermining trust in vaccines. I spoke with Patricia Glassetter. She's the public health nurse for Nashua. She said she has patients who are, you know, now expressing that they're nervous about the new guidance. They don't really understand why these guidelines have shifted and whether they should still vaccinate their children according to the old schedules or the new schedules. And so that's creating some extra work and confusion for folks.
So what are pediatricians saying to their patients that are a little confused?
I think they're trying to really have those conversations with them, honestly. They're trying to provide them all of the scientific evidence and backing for the vaccines. You know, the fact is that the science behind these vaccines is solid. So they're sharing that. And just it takes more time, I think, for them to have those conversations with patients and really address all of their concerns.
Now, lawmakers here are considering proposals that could eliminate some or even all vaccination requirements for kids. Well, what are the current requirements exactly, and what kind of support can we expect for those bills?
So it's important to know that, you know, right now, parents really do have a choice about whether or not to vaccinate their children. But the state does require some vaccines in order for children to attend daycare or enroll in a school. There's about 10 vaccines that children have to get in order to participate in school or daycare: diphtheria, mumps, pertussis. There's a whole list. Mm-hmm. As far as support for these bills, the second part of your question, you know, what I'm hearing is that while these bills may gain some support in the House, they are likely to face headwinds potentially in the Senate and when it comes to Governor Kelly Ayotte. Mm-hmm. She has been skeptical about bills that would undermine public health or vaccination rates in the state in the past.
Okay, we'll be watching and see what happens, and I know you'll be reporting on it as well. Amanda Gokey, reporter for the Boston Globe. Amanda, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Rick.
You can find more of her work at bostonglobe.com/New Hampshire. And we're here next Friday with more. I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR.